జయ రాధా మాధవ కుంజ బిహారీ జయ రాధా మాధవ కుంజ బిహారీ జయ గోపీ జనవల్లభ గిరివర ధారి జయ గోపీ జనవల్లభ గిరివర ధారి యశోదానందనుభుజ చంద్రరాజనుభుజ చంద్రరాజనుయామునతేరవనచారి తీరవనచారి జయ రాధ మాధవ కుంజ బిహారి జయ రాధ మాధవ కుంజ బిహారి జయ రాధ మాధవ కుంజ బిహారి జయ గోపీ జనవల్లభ గిరివర ధారి జయ గోపీ జనవల్లభ గిరివర ధారి యశోదానందనుభుజ చంద్రరాజనుయామునతేరవనచారి యామునతేరవనచారి హరే కృష్ణ 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 హరి 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 రాము 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 హరి 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 కృష్ణ జయ ప్రభుపదా జయ ప్రభుపదా జయ ప్రభుపదా జయ ప్రభుపదా జయం విష్ణు పాద పరమహంస పరబ్రహ్మాచార్య ఆస పురుషత శ్రీ శ్రీమద్ హిస్ డివైన్ గ్రేస్ ఏసి భక్తి వేదాంత స్వామి శ్రీల ప్రభుపాద కీ జయ. ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Ananta Gaudiya Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. And all glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Somebody take it. Nothing in it. Good, there wasn't anything in it. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Before beginning, I just want to thank everyone here for coming and giving me an opportunity to offer some service to all of you, as well as to Srila Prabhupada, Rukmini, and Dwarkadish, Shri Jagannath, Baladev, Lady Subhadra, and Shri Gornitai. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to share these teachings, and I pray for your blessings that I may be able to say something useful and valuable or beneficial for all of us, including myself, so that we can all go on in our spiritual path, making nice advancement, pleasing Krishna, pleasing Srila Prabhupada, pleasing the spiritual master, which assures us of further advancement. Thank you. Surasuranam udahim matnatham mandarachalam tadrekhamatha rupena prishta ekharashe vibhu. Surasuranam udadim matnatham mandarachalam dadre kamatha rupena prishta ekadashe vibhu. Surasuranam udadim matnatham mandarachalam tadre kamatha rupena prishta ekadashe vibhu. This is the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 3, Text 16, for those of you who have books or who are online. Yes, please. Surasuranam udadim. Ladies, please. synonyms. Sura, the theists. Asaranam, of the atheists. Udadhim, in the ocean. Matnatam, churning. Mandarachalam, the Mandarachala hill. Dadre, sustained. Kamata, tortoise. Rupena, in the form of. Prishte, shell. Ikadashe, the 11th in the line. Vibhu, the great. Translation by Srila Prabhupada Ki. The 11th incarnation of the Lord took the form of a tortoise whose shell served as a pivot for the Mandarachala hill, which was being used as a churning rod by the theists and atheists of the universe. Sorry. Please repeat. The 11th incarnation of the Lord took the form of a tortoise whose shell served as a pivot for the Mandarachala hill, which was being used as a churning rod by the theists and atheists of the universe. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Once both the atheists and the theists, that means the demons and the demigods, were engaged in producing nectar from the sea. This is not a salty sea, it's a milky sea, so that all of them could become deathless by drinking it. At that time, the Mandarachala hill was used as the churning rod, and the shell of Lord Tortoise, also known as Lord Kurma, the incarnation of Godhead, became the resting place or pivot of the hill in the seawater. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Ummilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto his lotus feet. So this is a very fascinating pastime. I think you'll find it in the 8th canto. Trying to find it in the index here, but yes, find it in the 8th canto from the 5th chapter on to the 11th chapter. It's very long and it's very fascinating. If ever a movie should be made, that one should be. It is so full of twists and turns and so full of surprises and so many entertaining facets that you just sit there entranced and enthralled. It's really truly great, and maybe when some of our movie makers keep rising in the firmament of movie making, we'll have such a movie as this. In the meantime, you'll just have to settle for a mere reading from myself, coming from my book, Mystical Stories from the Bhagavatam. Some of you may have read it. But of course, I can't read the whole story. It would take up more than an hour and a half, even the abridged edition. So what I will read is just that part which pertains to the translation and the purport, and I'll try to fill in by abridging or giving a précis of how the actual story ends. I think it would be torture if I left you in the middle and you don't know how it ends. You know, it's like being yanked out of a movie just at 3/4 of the end and you're pulled out, or the lights come on and say, well, that's it, folks, all over. You feel disappointed, you feel frustrated, you feel dumbfounded. So I'll try to finish the story as well, but what I will do now is read to the best of my ability from this story. As I said, it's an abridgment, and it's done, written in the novelistic style. By that I mean it's been calculated to be presented for persons who know nothing about Krishna consciousness and who I had a very strong desire to try to lure them into it by this incredibly great story, by tapping into the emotions that many do have in this particular regard, as we will see. There are so many wonderful stories, and not stories, but instructions, and I will try my very best with Krishna's grace and Srila Prabhupada's grace to indicate them as I go along the reading. It will not just be a straight reading as I do on some of my tapes or CDs. This is called the churning for nectar. At one time, Lord Indra, king of the gods, had so much false pride that he didn't even know he had offended the powerful yogi Durvasa. But the yogi knew it and was firmly determined to teach Indra a painful lesson for his offense. Thus, Durvasa cursed Indra in a way that he would never forget. What had happened was that while the yogi was strolling along a road, he saw Indra riding on the back of his elephant, wearing a flower garland on his neck. Durvasa was pleased to remove it and respectfully offer it to Indra, since Indra thought he was certainly worthy of it and of much more. He proudly accepted the wreath, but instead of appreciatively placing it over his own neck, he just hung it on the trunk of his elephant. So that's also a very big instruction there. And we will see how by not addressing the fact that Yogi Durvasa was giving it as a way of saying, of showing his respect, his appreciation, his honor to Lord Indra. But Lord Indra was just taking it for granted. I'm great, I'm wonderful, I'm glorious, and I'm worthy of this. So what's the big deal? It's just a garland. I don't even want to wear it. I'll just put it on my elephant. Let him put it on his trunk. Let him wear it. So we see what was happening. This is not a proper attitude in which to accept gifts. Even if it's your worst enemy, if your worst enemy gives you a gift and gives it to you with at least a slight smile, the best thing is to accept it graciously and thank the person, because that may be a first step in trying to become a friend. We never know. So we accept gifts, but we outwardly accept them and thank the person for his thought, for his affection, for his consideration, and inwardly we consider that the gift is a love from the love of Krishna coming through that particular devotee. And so we thank the Lord from within, and we don't leave it at that. We take the gift in our mind and offer it to the spiritual master first. And then observe the spiritual master offering it to Krishna, and then Krishna accepts the offering. To the degree of love that we have made the offering, to that degree does Krishna cherish the offering. If there is no love, then why should Krishna cherish it? He may not even accept it. So it is important that all gifts be given with respect and honor and love. And we can see that Durvasa did. He didn't have to offer anything to Indra. We know that Durvasa is a very big-time yogi in his own right, has numerous mystical powers. But he was on the road and he thought, there is a great devotee, he's chief of the gods. Let me give him a gift. So, continuing. Being only an animal, the elephant could not understand the value or significance of the garland. Consequently, he threw the wreath between his legs and then stomped on it. The yogi construed this to mean that Indra did not consider the garland valuable enough for himself to wear, and thus gave it to his ignorant pachyderm. This, of course, was highly offensive to Durvasa. Therefore, he bellowed, "I curse you, Indra!" Confirmed. "I curse you, Indra, to lose all your opulence and become poverty stricken." Those are powerful words coming from Durvasa, and they cannot be baffled unless Indra were a pure devotee, which he is not. He's a devotee, but not pure. In due course of time, Indra, along with all the gods, lost his wealth. Moreover, in a big battle against the demons, many of the gods were killed. Thus, the gods became bereft of all their power and influence. But who were the gods and the demons? The gods were Aditi's sons, and the demons were Diti's and Danu's. All three women being married to the sage Kashyapa. The gods were often referred to as the Adityas, and they had been entrusted by the Supreme Lord Vishnu with managing the universe. Thus, they were responsible for the activities of the sun, moon, wind, water, rain, etc. But under God's direction, they did not work independently. They did not work apart or without thought of what God's will was, of what God wanted. They were servants of the Lord. They never considered themselves independent of him, and except for occasional lapses, they were generally obedient and submissive. Just one example of a lapse is King Indra, when the Govardhan, before the Govardhan sacrifice was made, it was supposed to be a sacrifice for Indra, but Krishna convinced the residents of Vrindavan to not make the sacrifice for him because he was not really responsible for the rain. Indra made rain, or was enabled to make rain, by virtue of Krishna's blessings, Krishna's power, Krishna's understanding, empowerment. So Krishna discouraged that, and Indra became, of course, very angry, and as a result, he tried to drown not only Krishna, but the residents of Vrindavan, but it all backfired on him, and he had to beat a hasty retreat and stop his shenanigans, his stupid, foolish attempts to harm the residents of Vrindavan, and that made him even more humble than he ever had been, because he realized that he was nothing and Krishna was everything. The demons, being sons of Diti and Danu, were known as Daityas and Danavas, respectively. But collectively, they were called Asuras, or demons. This was because they were generally opposed to obeying God's laws and rules, and preferred to live independently of him. Filled with lust, anger, greed, pride, and envy, they often tried to establish their own divinity or power over the universe. This they did by acquiring superhuman powers, which they usually use for aggrandizing and domineering purposes. As a result, they frequently clashed with their half-brothers, the gods. They're both born from the father, Kashyapa Muni, but they had different mothers, Aditi for the gods and Diti for the demons. As a result, they frequently clashed with their half-brothers, the gods, and became their bitter enemies, sometimes even declaring war on them. Since the gods were now in a deplorable condition, they asked Lord Brahma, their grandfather, and the first created being, for guidance. Brahma suggested that they visit and take shelter of Lord Vishnu, for he had always been very kind and dear to them, because they were his devotees, and they generally obeyed him. They generally glorified him. They generally honored him. They generally applauded him. They generally sang great, beautiful songs to him. So the Lord was pleased with them, and he often reciprocated by assisting and helping them. Brahma suggested that they visit and take shelter of Lord Vishnu, for he had always been very kind and dear to them. Thus the gods, as a group, traveled to the pole star, Dhruvaloka. There they went to an island called Shvetadvip that was situated in the ocean of milk. Although they did not see the Lord there, they knew it was his abode. Lord Brahma worshipped him with beautiful prayers that extolled his omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence. He also glorified him as the source of all creation and the cause of all causes, and begged that he be pleased with them. Satisfied by their prayers, the Lord suddenly appeared before them. His bodily effulgence resembled thousands of suns. Thus the gods were temporarily blinded. However, after a while, their eyes adjusted to the illumination, and they were able to see him. Gazing at his gorgeous form was like drinking the sweetest of nectar. He had a blackish body, reddish eyes, four mighty arms, and an attractive smiling face. He was decorated with jewels, earrings, armlets, and bangles, as well as belts, garlands, and necklaces, and ankle bells. He held a disc in one hand, a club in a second hand, a lotus in a third, and a conch shell in a fourth. Overwhelmed by his compelling appearance, the gods prostrated themselves at his lotus-like feet in a mood of total surrender. So this is how great persons meet or greet greater persons. They offer their full-out obeisances in great appreciation and an attitude of gratitude that they are getting this incredible, this very cherishable opportunity to see he who is the highest, the greatest, and the best of all, the Supreme Lord Vishnu. So they offered their prayers. Again, this light is not exactly the best. Again, Lord Brahma offered him the best of prayers and begged for his precious mercy. Then the god stood up with folded palms and humbly awaited the Lord's response. In a deep voice that resembled rumbling clouds, the Lord said, "O gods, please listen to me carefully. Since you are not flourishing, you should make a truce with the demons. That will be in your best interest." Then he suggested a project that they could cooperatively engage in with the demons, but which would ultimately benefit the gods. With patience and serenity, everything can be accomplished. But if you become easily angered and disturbed, you will not achieve your goal. What should we do to keep things peaceful? Asked one of the gods. Agree to whatever the demons propose. The Lord then disappeared. All the gods then went to Tripura, the abode of King Bali, the demon leader. Since Bali had conquered the universe, his palace was extraordinarily opulent. The gods approached his throne in a peaceful manner, offering him proper respects. But his assistants suspected them of mischief. "What do you want here?" said one angrily. "We've come on a peace mission," said Indra. "Peace? Oh, sure," said another demon sarcastically. "They've come to spy on us," said a third. "Don't trust them." "Please believe us," pleaded Indra. "I say we kill them," said a second demon. "Yes, let's kill them," roared several other demons. But Bali lifted his arms and silenced them. "Let's first hear their proposal." He turned to Indra, offered him a seat near him, and suspiciously said, "Proceed. We would like you to help us churn the ocean of milk," said Indra. "For what purpose?" asked Bali. "To obtain nectar from it, to become immortal." "Nectar?" cried the demons, their eyes widening greedily. "Yes. What makes you so sure?" "It's there," Bali asked. "Because Lord Vishnu told me it is." Bali nodded and considered this. We have to remember that Bali is a dormant lover of Lord Vishnu. I say dormant because it hasn't become patent as of yet. It does become later when Lord Vamana enters the scene later on, not in this pastime. But at that time, there is a turning point in Lord Vamana's life. At this time, he's still a demon, but he has devotional tendencies, by the grace of his grandfather, Prahlad Maharaj, who prayed for his own father, Hiranyakasipu, to be liberated. And Lord Narasingadev, he said, not only will your father be liberated, but 11 generations forward will be liberated. So Bali is in that dynasty. Okay. Because a tremendous amount of man... So Bali nodded and considered this. So why do you need our help? And Indra said, because a tremendous amount of manpower will be needed. All right. But then who will keep the nectar? We'll share it, said Indra. Bali looked at his assistants for their response. That sounds fair, they said, nodding reluctantly. Then let's do it, said Bali. The rival parties then declared an armistice, peace, and cooperatively proceeded toward the ocean of milk. Following the instructions of the Lord had given to Indra, all the gods and demons gathered around the base of the golden Mount Mandara. That's the Mandarachala Hill. They were strongly built and were ready to use their superhuman might. When the leaders gave the signal, they all tried to dislodge the mountain from its deep foundation. Succeeding, they lifted it off the ground. As they strained to carry it toward the ocean, they moaned and groaned loudly. Loudly. It was so heavy that everyone became quickly fatigued. Consequently, they lost their grip on the mountain and it fell down with a thundering crash. Many of the warriors were crushed to death. Others' arms, thighs, and shoulders were broken. Frustrated and disheartened, they lamented loudly. What are we going to do? Knowing what had happened, the Lord instantly appeared there on the back of his eagle carrier, Garuda. So here again, we see that the Lord sees his devotees in trouble, in difficulty, and he wants to help them. So what does he do? He appears there to give them the help, which they needed absolutely, because without his help, they would not be able to achieve what they had started out to attempt. Knowing what had happened, the Lord instantly appeared there on the back of his eagle carrier, Garuda. He dismounted and compassionately glanced over the dead and wounded bodies, fully reviving them. As the resurrected men looked about and climbed to their feet, they were incredulous. Those who had died pinched themselves to make sure they were alive. And those who had been disabled stretched their limbs to be sure those parts were again usable. They looked at each other and laughed loudly, hardly able to believe the miracle. The gods raised their arms high with clenched fists and shouted, "Glory to Lord Vishnu!" repeatedly. The demons did not cry the same thing. Why not? Why not? Because Lord Vishnu killed two of their main men in the past. And what were their names? Come on. The first big time demons. Lord, huh? Hiranyakashipu? Yeah? No, before that, it goes. The two demons, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. So Lord Vishnu killed them both. So the demons, of course, not forgetting that, were not in the mood for glorifying Lord Vishnu. Now, that's the reason. They don't have a great, good, loving sentiments toward him. The Lord easily raised the mountain with one hand and placed it securely on Garuda's back. The gods and demons were astounded. They cheered and roared, quite certain now that they would secure the coveted nectar. The gods continued chanting, "Glory to Vishnu," again and again. We should understand that this nectar, when drunk, it enables a person to be free of all physical diseases, the threefold miseries, actually, and allows a person to remain physically capable or physically able until it's time for Lord Brahma to actually go to sleep. So it's a long time that they can remain and enjoy. And of course, the demons are into big time enjoying. And so they, of course, wanted the nectar. And the demigods also wanted to remain. Because demigods and demons, they do die, as it was mentioned earlier. Where do they go? Many of them go. Some go to higher planets, and some come to the earth planets. And some, if they're really naughty, they go to the lower planets. So, therefore, they all wanted to stay in this heavenly, with a small h, heavenly realm, where they could continue enjoying unlimitedly and ideally, with quotes on the word, eternally. Next, the Lord mounted Garuda and directed him to the ocean of milk, the gods and demons eagerly following. Arriving there, Garuda lowered the mountain into the milk. The Lord then asked Garuda to leave the area. Does anybody know why he asked Garuda to leave the area? It's very fascinating and a little bit humorous. The gods and demons summoned the giant thousand-headed serpent Vasuki from the netherworld, that's the lower planets, Patala, promising to give him a fair share of the nectar if he participated. When he agreed, they coiled him around the mountain and would soon use him as a churning rope. Just to give some clarity, we all have seen many of the pictures in which the gopis are churning milk into cream. They have these two ropes going back and forth, back and forth. Similarly, there's the mountain, and then now they have Vasuki wrapped around the mountain, and there's a head on one side, and there's a tail on the other side. And they're going to pull the head and the tail this way, that way, and this way to get the nectar to arise from the bottom of the ocean to the surface. That's the idea. So, here's what happens. The Lord and the gods clasped the head portion of the snake, expecting the demons to grab the rear end. But the demon leaders were averse to this arrangement. We don't want to hold that part. It brings bad luck. We want to hold the front part. The front? Yes, the good luck part. The Lord smiled and said, all right, we'll switch positions. So the demons held the head, and the gods and Lord held the tail. Then, I mean, after all, the Lord is there. How can there be any inauspiciousness? But that showed the density of their consciousness, that the Lord makes it all good and favorable and auspicious, but they're just thinking he's just some big, powerful guy up there, you know, who's got some mystical powers. So, the demons held the head, and the gods, and Lord Vishnu held the tail. Then they began to vigorously churn Mount Mundra with all the energy they could summon. Their rhythmic shouts of heave ho, heave ho, greatly inspired each other. However, because the mountain had no base on which to rest securely, it fell splashing into the milk. Deeply disappointed, the men let out a mournful cry, oh, and their faces shriveled in disgust. It seemed as if all their hard work had come to naught. Noting the hopeless situation, the Lord assumed the form of a giant tortoise known as, come on, we said it three times already, Kurma, yes, Kurma, and dove into the milk. The gods and demons waited eagerly to see why he had done this. Then the peak of Mount Mundra began to rise slowly above the milky surface. Soon, more and more of it appeared till most of the mountain became visible. Enlivened and encouraged, the men shouted joyously. Now they could understand that Lord Kurma had swam under the mountain and somehow had lifted it upright onto his massive shell. The gods and demons reassumed their positions and with renewed hope began to churn the mountain energetically. As Mount Mundra rotated back and forth on Kerma's shell, the Lord felt the pleasurable sensation one feels when one's itchy back is vigorously scratched. He also continued to infuse the men with an ever-increasing quantity of strength. Then atop the swiveling mountain, he manifested another incredible form. This is a third form now. That shows you how loving and kind and sweet and generous and compassionate the Lord is. He'll make any number of forms to help the gods accomplish their ultimate goal, which was to defeat the demons, regain their wealth, regain their opulence, regain their property, and get the demons back to a defeated position. So, then Lord Vishnu, atop the swiveling mountain, he manifested another incredible form, this one with thousands of arms, and sat there cross-legged, keeping Mundra firmly balanced with one of his hands. Thus the Lord assisted them from both above and below. He's underneath the water as Kurma, and he's above as Lord Vishnu with thousands of arms. Seeing this, the appreciative chief gods replicated their bodies and, from above, showered countless flowers on him. The ocean of milk was so intensely agitated that all the creatures living in it, alligators, fishes, sharks, tortoises, whales, etc., became fearfully perturbed. But the gods and demons, ignoring them, continued churning the milk. Nothing could stop them now from producing the nectar except one thing: the blazing fire and choking smoke that emitted from Vasuki's thousands of mouths. Gradually, it afflicted them and diminished their strength. The smoke blackened their faces, garments, and weapons, and they soon looked like a sorry lot. No longer able to continue churning, they merely stood there, stooped over, hopeless and lusterless. Seeing their pathetic condition, the Lord immediately produced in the sky billows of rain clouds. Then torrents of rain fell and gusty winds swirled about. This brought the men instant relief. But when the Lord saw that after so much endeavor, the nectar still had not come, he decided to personally help. Grabbing Vasuki, he began churning the milk vigorously. As he worked steadily, he himself looked like a magnificent mountain. So here again we see how kind, how caring, how affectionate, how loving the Supreme Lord can be. His devotees, they could not go on. They were just, you know, the smoke was just choking them. Their strength was going, diminishing. So he took control in order for them to succeed. From this we learn that we should always learn to depend upon Krishna. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, "In all activities, just depend upon me and work under my protection. In such devotional service, be fully conscious of me. If you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but you act through false ego, me, 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 I, mine, 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 instead of Krishna, you, Krishna, you, Krishna. No, me, my. If you work in that consciousness, you will be defeated. You will lose, and you will be miserable." Seeing their pathetic condition, the Lord immediately produced these rain clouds. But then something terrible happened. The first substance that rose to the surface of the ocean was not nectar at all. It was poison. And it spread all over the sea, called Hala Hala. It was extremely dangerous. If it were not quickly eliminated, it would endanger everyone in the universe. Therefore, before any further churning could be done, the poison would have to be removed. Of course, the Lord, being omnipotent, could have easily accomplished this himself. But because, again, here is the compassion, here is the affection, here is the love that the Lord has for his devotees, he often enjoys giving glory to his great devotees. He suggested that they all beg Lord Shiva to help solve the problem. So I'm going to stop reading here, and I'll just summarize the rest of this story because we're running short for time. So what happens is they go to Mount Kailash. They petition Lord Shiva if he would please drink the poison that they themselves could not do. And Lord Shiva, he considers this, and he has his wife Bhavani, and he asks for her consideration. He just doesn't do it. He respects her as an important part of his life. And he says, what do you think I should do? He says, it's very charitable if we can relieve the universe of all the pain and suffering that they're going through. She says, yes, go ahead and do it. That'd be fine. So that's what he does. He goes to the ocean of milk, which has now become poison, and he drinks all the poison. And when he does that, you know, he takes it, there's a big blue mark. He's called Nilakanta. That means the blue-throated one. That's what Lord Shiva is known as. And he takes all the poison in his inside, and he is able to neutralize it, and he is never affected by it. So then the poison is gone, and the next thing is different items start coming up. I'll just name a few of those items that came out. As soon as the ocean became free of poison, the happy gods and demons resumed churning the milk with renewed alacrity. After a while, various items were stirred to the ocean's surface. A cow, a Sarabi, a white horse, Ushai Shrava, a white elephant, Iravata, 8 male and 8 female elephants, and sparkling jewels, Kostaba and Padmarga. But where was the nectar, they wondered. As they continued churning, other items rose to the ocean surface, fragrant flowers, Parijata, dancing ladies, Apsaras, and Goddess Lakshmi and Goddess Varuni. These items were divided fairly between the gods and the demons, but Lakshmi and the jewels were allotted to Lord Vishnu, because Lord Vishnu is her eternal consort. She can't go to the god, to the demons. It's not allowed. So, but what about the nectar? Where was it? Then suddenly, Dhanvantari, a partial incarnation of the Lord, acting as a god, small g, rose to the surface. Especially conversant in medical science, he was handsome, well-built, strong, adorned, and well-dressed. In one of his hands, he was carrying a vase. Everyone wondered, what was in the vase? And Dhanvantari answered, nectar! The gods and demons roared with delight, some raising their arms victoriously, others clapping feverishly. Now listen to this. But some of the demons became intensely greedy. One of them forcefully snatched the vase from Dhanvantari's hand and eagerly hastened away to the shore. The other demons joyfully followed him. They were absolutely thrilled, for now they could have all the nectar for themselves. Now they could become virtually immortal, and no god would ever dare challenge or fight with them again. They would rule the universe forever. So they hoped, so they thought, so they imagined. And the gods would have to serve them as fawning menials, like servants. They cheered and praised the good fortune, feeling the heady pleasure of a great conquest. But what about the gods? They weren't at all happy. In fact, they were quite morose, since they were not powerful enough now to fight and defeat the demons. They thus sought shelter of the feet of the Lord Vishnu. The Lord said, don't be sad. I have a plan to help you. The gods wondered, what was the plan? Would they ever get the nectar? It seemed practically impossible now. Then something strange happened. One demon said to the others, I want to drink the nectar first. But another demon challenged, No, I want to drink the first. Why you, said a third, I want it. No, I want it, said a fourth. No, you give it to me, said a fifth. They continued bickering this way for a while, till one of the weaker demons exclaimed, the gods work just as hard as we, so they should also get some. Never, said one of the stronger demons. Why not? Because they don't deserve any.
That's not true.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. We should give them some.
Over my dead body, we will. One demon grabbed the nectar vase from the one who had snatched it from Don Vantari. But the first demon wrested it back. Then another demon seized it, and still another jerked it from him. This dispute was just about to become a melee when suddenly their attention was irresistibly captured. A young, gorgeous woman was strolling towards them. She was so ravishing that the demons completely forgot their disagreement. As she gradually drew closer, they just gazed at her seductive gait, her walk, with lustful absorption. She had, then there's a description, I won't go into it. We all know what beautiful women look like. I mean, all you have to do is see the Academy Awards, see one of them, and you see all the beauties, or Miss Universe, or any of those. When she glanced at them in a coy manner, this is very fascinating because it shows you how men can be so easily captured by beautiful women and how they lose their reason, how they lose their thoughtfulness, how they become emotionally absorbed and they begin to make decisions which are not in their best interest. When she glanced at them in a coy manner, you know, kind of like, you know, that kind of thing. When she glanced at them in a coy manner, I'm not a woman, I can't imitate, you know. So each demon could think of only one thing. And what did they think of? I must have her and make her mine. They began conversing about her. Who is she? Asked one demon. I don't know. I've never seen such beauty, said a third. Neither have I, said a fourth. Let's find out about her, said the second. They hurried over to her. And the first demon said, oh, beautiful one, who are you? But she just smiled flirtatiously at them, arousing them even more. Please tell us your name, asked the first demon eagerly. My name is Mohini Murti. Oh, what a lovely name, said the second demon. And where are you from? Oh, that's not really important, she smiled. But what's a pretty lady like you doing here? The third demon asked. Nothing in particular. And who's your father? Does it really matter? The demons glanced at each other, surprised by her indifferent answer. You're obviously not married, guessed the second demon.
That's true.
The demon's eyes opened wider, and some of them began licking their lips. Are you looking for a husband? The first demon asked, hopefully. But Mohini Murti just smiled shyly at them. They construed that to mean that she was desiring to involve her in their lives so that they could get closer to her. The demon holding the nectar said, we were just having a little dispute about the nectar. Nectar, she asked. I was wondering if you might be interested in settling this dispute for us. What's your dispute about? The first demon explained everything to her. Mohini Murti smiled at them. Remember, this is Lord Vishnu, this Mohini Murti. This is the Supreme Lord. This is his little trick that he mentioned to the demigods that he would pull on them. Mohini Murti smiled at them. But, she said, the first demon explained, what's your dispute about? The first demon explained everything to her. Mohini Murti smiled at them. But I'm only a prostitute. So how can I help you settle this? The demon's eyes, their eyebrows jumped up in surprise. Why would a woman so beautiful, who could virtually have any great man in the world as her husband, be a prostitute? Her statement made no sense to them. Thus, they refused to even believe it. Why do you have so much faith in me? She further asked. A learned person never puts his faith in a woman. The demons nodded and chuckled, thinking she was just jesting. Independent women like me seek new friends daily. You can never have a permanent relationship with a woman like me. But the demons were so strongly enamored of her that they felt she would never betray them. Confident of her sincerity, the demon holding the nectar handed her the vase. "Please distribute this fairly between us and the gods." She looked at the nectar for a few moments, then back at the demons. "I will do so on one condition only."
"And what's that?" several demons asked.
"That you accept whatever I do, whether it's honest or dishonest." But believing she could never be dishonest, they optimistically said, "Yes, of course we accept." The moment was nearing when the gods and demons would receive their share of the nectar. Now, this is really important, and I'm going to end it at that point. Since it was an auspicious occasion, they fasted, bathed, and gave charity. Next, they performed ritualistic ceremonies under the direction of learned Brahmins. Then they heard a tinkling of ankle bells coming from the entranceway. It was she, Mohini Murti, holding the nectar in her hands and wearing an exquisite-looking sari. She ambled across the smooth floor. The men could not help gazing at her ample breasts, at her full swaying hips, and at her lovely adorned face. When she charmingly glanced and smiled at them, they were completely enchanted. In fact, they could scarcely even think of nectar now, so beguiling was she. Mohini Murti had the demons sit down in a line on kusha grass, on mats, according to their rank. Then she led the gods to a spot some distance away from the demons and had them also sit in a line on the same type of mats. Returning to the demons, she flashed them a winsome smile that surely made their hearts skip a beat. Then she said, "All of you look so handsome now. There's nothing that a man loves more than a beautiful woman praising him, admiring him, looking up to him. It makes his ego just expand millions of miles." So he's completely captured, surrendered at the feet of such a person, as we will see. "All of you look so handsome now," she said. The demon smiled with feigned modesty. "I've never seen such powerful looking men," she said. Some of the demons tensed their muscles just to confirm her statement. You know, like the muscle guys you see, and they pull up their chest, do this kind of thing. So then she changed the subject. "I was just talking with the gods," and the demons became anxious and curious. "And I think they're very miserly." They laughed in agreement. "What a smart lady. Yes, the gods are miserly. They kept saying to me, 'Please let us drink the nectar first.' They were so nervous." The demon smiled contemptuously at them. "They weren't at all like you," she said, "so peaceful and patient." "So you know what I think?" she said. "What?" asked the demons. "Since you're so much more mature than they, why not let them drink the nectar first?" "First?" asked a few demons apprehensively. "Yes, that will show them how superior you are to them." The demons nodded smugly, relishing her every word, feeling that she liked them more than the gods. They believed she would give the gods only a few little teensy-weensy drops of the nectar and reserve the lion's share for them. They couldn't wait to start drinking it and receiving its amazing, vivifying benefits. No disease, no old age, and no death except when it was time for the world to end. But there was this is the story of Rahu. I'm going to skip that because it's not germane to the story itself. So what she did is she waved to the demons amiably and then strolled over to the gods. "Time for the nectar," she said. Each god clutched his goblet. When she came before the chief god, he extended his arm and she poured a goodly amount into his glass. He tasted it with gusto and sighed with delight. Never before had the drink been such a delicious beverage. The demons, trying not to look obvious,
kept glancing over at Mohini Murti. They were concerned about how much nectar she was giving to the gods and whether there would be enough left for them. Would there be some thought? Of course there would. She herself had indicated that she favored them over the gods. Hadn't she said that the demons were superior to them? Definitely. Thus, there was nothing to worry about. Or was there? Mohini Murti went from one god to the next, filling up goblet after goblet. As she did, the demons became increasingly anxious. When she tilted the vase to pour the nectar, they noticed that soon it was only half filled, then one quarter filled, then one eighth filled, then almost nothing left. How could she do that, they wondered. She had told them how much more she cared for them than for the gods, and now they could scarcely believe it. Thus, they began discussing the matter quietly among themselves. She favored the gods, said one of the demons. Nobody betrays us without suffering, a third demon said. But what can we do, said a fourth. We promised that we would accept whatever she would do, whether it was honest or dishonest. The others nodded pensively. If we break our promise, continued the fourth, she'll get angry at us. Right, said the second. And I don't know about you, but I'd like to keep our relationship friendly with her. See how their lust controls them. Although disappointed and glum, the others agreed. There was something mystically charming about having a woman as gorgeous as Mohini Murti friendly to them. It somehow made them feel bigger than they actually were. And who knows, they thought, she might even want to marry one of them. Anything was possible. Therefore, they remained patiently silent. Meanwhile, as Mohini Murti filled up Rahu, well, then there's Rahu and there's a thing about, I'm passing by this. Mohini Murti smiled at them as they drew closer. And then, in an instant, she was no longer a woman. She was the Supreme Lord Vishnu. The demons halted, their eyes and mouths wide open in surprise and shock. Ha! He tricked us! He tricked us. It wasn't a woman at all. It was Lord Vishnu, some of them said, seeing Lord Vishnu's whirling disc and knowing that it was the most powerful weapon in existence, they refrained from attacking him, but they would not allow the gods to escape with their wrath. Never. So they sallied forth and assailed them, the battle moving outside onto the beach. So, just to give the ending of this, I won't go into all the reading of it. What happens is that there's a big battle, and the demons, of course, they're worsted. The gods had all the nectar, they had the energy, they had the power, they had the gusto, they had this sense of superiority. They won the battle, and the demons, they got defeated, and the demigods then went back to their planets, which they had lost previously to the demons as a result of that offense that Indra had committed against Durvasa Muni. And so the demigods, at least for a while, lived happily, not ever after, but after some time. Thank you very much. Sorry to hold you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Hare Krishna. Thank you.